It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll get a handle on the science of cheese.
But first, the deadline to get nomination signatures in for this fall's elections is just around the bend. Candidates need to have the paperwork filed by 5 o'clock today.
People with signatures will appear on the fall ballot, and any primary race will take place in August.
Jason Stein joins us now for a look at these races. He's a Capitol reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, the marquee race this year in Wisconsin is the race for governor. Mary Burke expected to be Governor Walker's Democratic challenger. I don't think there's any question of whether those two are going to get enough signatures, first of all.
No. I mean, both sides said they turned in around the maximum number for a gubernatorial candidate, which is 4,000. That's about twice the minimum number needed. So one out of two signatures would have to be bad for one of those two to fail to make it on the ballot.
Outgoing state representative now, Brett Halsey, wants to be a challenger in this race as well. And that's, if anybody's holding their breath on this one, it's whether he might get the signatures in.
Right. He told me this morning that he had 2,200. I have not seen those. You know, that's what he says he has. He's going to need to get those in pretty soon. He said he was going to talk to me before he did that, but I haven't heard from him. So, you know, we'll see what he has at the end of the day.
A signature collecting is one of the more mundane elements of any political campaign, but it does happen sometimes. Usually, I think, at smaller races that the parties or the candidates will want to go through the other side's signatures, see if they can ding enough to keep somebody off of the ballot. Does that happen often?
It happens sometimes. I mean, you do see it. Where it typically will happen, where it sort of separates the people from who are just toying with the race and have publicly talked about it from the people that are really running. I mean, one case that I remember was when State Rep. John Nygren wanted to challenge one of the senators from Green Bay in the recall election.
Right.
Right, exactly. And John got just enough signatures but failed to get on the ballot because a few of them were invalidated.
Yeah, that's not a happy moment for any candidate, I'm sure.
No, it's certainly not. I mean, it's sort of like political malpractice. If a campaign manager fails to get has a legitimate candidate and fails to get the number of signatures needed.
Well, let's stay with the legislature. There have been a fair amount of retirements announced from the Wisconsin State Legislature this year. Are there any districts around the state, Senate or Assembly, that you have your eye on, you think might be interesting or hotly contested this year?
Oh, sure. There's certainly going to be some. The race to secede is something else in politics.
It has come up in Wisconsin this year, though.
You do occasionally get some stories about it. That race between to succeed Senate President Mike Ellis, mm-hmm. which involves Penny Bernard-Shaber, a Democrat, and Roger Roth, a Republican, is one that has seen a little bit of interest. Another one would be the race to replace Senator Dale Schultz on the western side of Wisconsin, on the other side of the state. So, I mean, there's certainly going to be some races that are competitive. We'll see whether or not the overall houses are competitive.
And those, the idea in both of those were Republican senators viewed as, if not moderate, as more moderate than the rest of their colleagues, leaving, probably going to be replaced by more conservative Republican candidates. But Democrats thinking, well, if we've been electing moderate Republicans, maybe there's room here for a moderate Democrat.
Right. I mean, with political dynamics being what they are, anytime you have somebody that's been in the legislature for a long time and has a profile of occasionally voting against his or her party, typically when they leave, they're going to be replaced by someone either, you know, from whichever party, they're going to be replaced by someone who votes with their party more often. That's just simply the way the world has worked in recent years.
And you briefly mentioned whether either house might change hands, both the Assembly and the Senate. Republicans control them. it doesn't seem like there's much thought that the Democrats have a shot at taking either of them at this point.
Right. I mean, obviously the assembly is 60-39. So that given the effects of redistricting and a number of other factors, it's just not feasible, at least given the current state of races, to imagine the Democrats taking back that House. The Senate, there's a slim possibility. It's 18-15, so it's certainly closer. But they will certainly have their work cut out for them, because one seat, the seat now belonging to John Lehman, changed considerably as a result of redistricting. So John Lehman, who is not running for re-election in that seat, he's running for lieutenant governor, that seat is certainly going to go to the Republicans. So Democrats already start out with kind of in the races with that one seat deficit. So it'll be a challenge for them.
And then back to the statewide level, the next biggest race is the one for attorney general. It's going to be an open seat with incumbent J.B. Van Hollen not running again. Three Democrats, I think, one Republican in the race. What do you make the candidates so far?
You know, in that race, you have one Republican, Waukesha County District Attorney Brad Schimmel. He's had a pretty active campaign. Just today, he put out a plan for dealing with the heroin epidemic in the state. You have three Democrats, one state rep, John Richards, and then you have Jefferson County District Attorney Susan Happ and Dane County DA Ishmael Ozan. You know, we'll see in those races. I mean, they all have various things going for them. You know, for instance, Ozan and Richards are both from the two big blocks, the regions in the state where there are big blocks of Dem voters. Susan Happ has a profile of being able to win an election in a more Republican area as a Democrat. So they all have things that they can point to as strengths. You know, we'll see which one starts to mount the most viable campaign as things go forward.
They all participated in a forum. I think it was the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. All agreed. You mentioned heroin. That heroin was the biggest law and order issue affecting Wisconsin right now. Do you think that's going to be something they keep coming back to through the race?
Oh, I'm sure. I think because obviously in the state, cities, drugs are always going to be a major concern on the question of law and order. And we have seen in recent years also more focus on the problem of drugs such as heroin and methamphetamines in various rural areas or less urbanized parts of the state. So, I mean, that's going to be a natural one for campaigns and voters to focus on.
And then the other statewide races, maybe not such marquee ones, state treasurer and secretary of state. Are these things that... Well, I won't ask you if they matter exactly, but are people going to get worked up on these two campaigns if they're not running or related to someone?
I wouldn't expect them to get worked up about those races because, I mean, in all honesty, they don't matter. In most states, the Secretary of State is someone who has important duties such as running the state's elections and tracking its corporations, their, you know, their filings and so forth. In Wisconsin, the Secretary of State does neither. The state treasurer is also, again, an office that once upon a time had the, you know, some power of the purse or, you know, some control over the state's finances. That is no longer at all the case. Really, very few duties of any kind still relate to that office.
And Jason, before we let you go, in our last election cycle here, we were a swing state in a presidential election. We had a U.S. Senate seat up for grabs, got a lot of national attention. Are we going to get that kind of attention this time, or is this going to be more of an inside affair?
You know, we will certainly get attention. You know, there's not a lot of – there's obviously not a U.S. Senate race. The only right now – highly competitive congressional race is the race to succeed Tom Petri in the 6th congressional district, where you have one Democrat and several Republicans teeing off on that. Obviously, the governor's race is going to draw national attention. It already is. It will be in a maybe not in the top tier of races nationally, but certainly in the second tier, at least in that tier of races nationally.
Jason, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Jason Stein, Capitol reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, giving us a look at who may be on the fall election ballot. Today is the filing deadline. Annually, the average American eats 34 pounds of cheese, and a third of the milk made in the U.S. goes toward cheese making. Well, we're here in Wisconsin, and we live by the theory you can never eat too much cheese. We thought we'd try to get to know our cheese just a little bit better today.
Michael Tunick joins us now to help raise our cheese IQ. He's a research chemist with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service and the author of The Science of Cheese. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
So it's easy to take cheese for granted, especially here in Wisconsin, or just slap it on our cheeseburger and not think about it anymore. But as someone who's made it their mission in life, more or less, to study cheese, why should we learn more about it?
Just because of the science involved, science can get involved in quite esoteric things, that it's also involved in everyday things that you don't think about, and one of them is cheese, that there's quite a bit of science going on there, and so that's why I wrote the book.
Well, I want to start with one of the more burning questions about cheese relevant here in Wisconsin, especially fresh cheese curds. Why do they squeak? What do we know about that from the scientific perspective?
Well, the same thing as when you're taking a shower and you run your fingers down your hair and you get a squeak that way. What's happening is that you've got water and protein together, and you run your fingers down it, and you set up a vibration, and that vibration can be heard in the audible range. Same thing happens if you run some chalk down a chalkboard. If you do it a particular way, it squeaks. Same thing happens with cheese, is that when your teeth are going down on a piece of fresh cheese, then you're also getting that vibration. You don't get it so much after a few days, now that the water has kind of set up inside of the cheese matrix. But when you have a fresh curd, it will squeak because of that reason. Just think of yourself as taking a shower, and that's why the cheese squeaks.
Why cheese curds, though, and not, cheddar?
Well, that's because once cheese is more than a few days old, then the water has completely distributed itself within the protein matrix. The matrix has the protein and it also has the fat, has the water, has salt, and everything else. And so you have the water molecules are more trapped inside that matrix and they aren't as willing to come out. So when you run your teeth up and down a piece of cheddar that's been around for a little while, you're not going to get that squeaking sensation because the water isn't as readily available. It's more tied up with the protein.
Well, some varieties of cheese, so look at the history a bit, they go back ages. What are some of the oldest kinds of cheese?
Well, cheese has been made for a very long time, and the figure that it was something like 8,000 years ago when a traveler had stomach made probably from a sheep and had some milk in there, and he arrived at a destination and went to take a drink, and it had curdled into the curds and whey, and the curds were the cheese. So that would be like your first cottage cheese, more or less. But there have been other cheeses that are known to have been around for quite some time, depending, like Roquefort from the year 879 and that kind of thing. So they basically have different varieties that have been made for hundreds of years, and then you have others before that which are basically the same thing, which have been made even longer. So you have cheeses that have actually been made one way or another for a few thousand years, but they haven't called it the same thing the whole way down.
Well, we're talking right now to Michael Tunick. We're talking about the science of cheese. We eat an awful lot of it here in Wisconsin. A lot of fresh cheese curds, as we're hearing about. And we're talking about the science behind cheese. And we'll be learning more about things that we're going to raise our cheese IQ. You can reach us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page and go ahead and start asking your questions. And, Michael, I want to go back to some of the cheese science 101 types of questions here. How is cheese made? Can you give us a thumbnail sketch?
Okay. Well, we started like with that curds and whey business that I told you about. And you take milk and you add microorganisms to it if it's, the milk has been pasteurized. And what they do is start converting the lactose, the milk sugar, into lactic acid, and that starts the pH down, so it becomes more acidic. Then you also add rennet, which is the coagulant. Now, that originally came from the stomach of a calf or some other mammal, and now you can make it from a microbe. But both of those work together. The coagulant breaks the casein, which is the milk protein, at a particular spot, and that causes the protein to fall apart and coagulate into the curd. And the curd is what the cheesemaker then works with. So basically, they try to get rid of as much whey from the curd as possible, and the curd becomes is cut into different sized cubes depending on what kind of cheese you're working with. It's heated at different temperatures, again, depending on the kind of cheese, and eventually you have that curd, and then it gets pressed into a particular shape that you're looking for, and it's allowed to age for a while, and what you wind up with is cheese. And it all depends on what kind of cheese you're making as far as all these different parameters go. So you can get something from something like cottage cheese, which is really soft, to Parmesan, which is really hard, depending on all the different things that you're looking at.
Well, I want to take a phone call now. We've got John on the line from Onalaska. Hi, John.
Hi. I have some friends who think European cheese is much better than the cheese in the USA, and they say that it's because they don't pasteurize their milk. Tell us about that.
All right. Thanks so much for that question, John. That's a great question, Michael. You talk about people who are worried about what they call dead cheese here in the States.
Yeah, that's right. The thing is that when you pasteurize the milk, you're going to kill off not only the pathogens that you don't want in there, but you also kill off all of the naturally occurring beneficial microorganisms that you do want in there. So when you add the starter culture to it, that bacteria at the very beginning of the cheese making I just mentioned, you're adding back particular microorganisms that you want, and you go from there. Now, with the European cheeses, which are not pasteurized, you have all the microorganisms that were there coming straight out of the cow, and that will include some things which are not in a commercially prepared starter culture. So that means you're going to have a much larger array of flavors in an unpasteurized cheese because you have all these different bacteria which are going to be creating all these different compounds which you don't have in a pasteurized cheese. Now, the thing is that unpasteurized cheese is not legal in the United States unless you have certain things like it has to be aged for 60 days, so that eliminates any fresh cheeses. And so a lot of people are afraid to eat unpasteurized cheese, so therefore you get almost all the cheese in the United States is pasteurized, but it won't have as much flavor as an unpasteurized cheese.
And I think you say in your book somewhere, though, that if you do let a cheese sit there for 60 days, the organisms in the cheese that would worry you will have died off anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That's why they give it a 60-day minimum before you can market a unpasteurized cheese, that they figure that the dangerous microorganisms will have died out by then.
We're talking right now with Michael Tunick, a research chemist with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service, and he's the author of The Science of Cheese.
And this being Wisconsin, we bet you have questions or maybe some cheese-making experience of your own that you can share with us at 800-642-1234. Call in with a question about the science of cheese, how it's made, what makes different kinds of cheese taste the way they do.
We're talking with Michael Tunick, research chemist with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service and the author of The Science of Cheese.
And we want to hear your cheese questions. Are you curious about a particular kind of cheese, how it's made, what makes one type hard and tasty, one type soft and mellow? Or if you're a cheese maker, share your insights. Tell us about the cheese that went wrong. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And Michael, I want to ask you about stinky cheese. It's always controversial, even among people who love cheese. Some people just can't stomach the stinky stuff. And Limburger cheese, as an example of that, has a pretty fascinating cultural story. What can you tell us about how it fell out of favor?
Yes, well, Limburger, like these most of these stinky cheeses, is made by putting a culture on the outside. Brevibacterium linens is the name of it, and it's the same kind of microorganism that's found on your feet, on sweaty feet. So the
cheese actually does smell like feet.
That's right. And these are smear ripened cheeses, and they are not terribly flavorful on the inside. They're kind of bland, but if you can get past the aroma. But anyway, so Limburger has always been considered as the quintessential stinky cheese. Mark Twain wrote a story about it, and it's a monologue by a comedian on first record ever sold by the Victor Talking Machine Company. Charlie Chaplin had a movie, Soldier Arms, in which he received Limburger from a package from home and lobbed it into a trench of German soldiers to force their surrender. So anyway, when Prohibition began in 1920, all these immigrants to the United States couldn't go to their bars and eat Limburger cheese like they were used to. So when finally Prohibition ended, the popularity didn't recover. And then turned out that Bruno Hauptmann, who was convicted of kidnapping the Lindbergh baby, admitted that that was his favorite snack. So that really took care of the popularity. So it turns out that now it's about 650,000 pounds a year are made by one company in Monroe, Wisconsin.
Right, in Monroe, Wisconsin. Here in Wisconsin,
that's right.
We have the last Limburger factory in the States.
And that's right. It's they're making about one-tenth of what they used to make back in the early 50s, but it's still being made.
Interesting. And as far as sort of what the cows eat, I'm curious about that. And I guess when I was in New Zealand, I'm just going to dive off here for a while, I noticed their cheese tasted really, really different than cheese in America tastes, and it does here in Wisconsin. Is that because of what the cows eat? Can it make that big a difference?
Yes, it can, depending on whether the cows are confined in their stalls and eat regular total mixed ration, or whether they're allowed out on the fields and then where they can eat anything they want. So if you're in an area where they can eat, say, you know, flowers or something like that, then you're going to get that passed on to the cheese. If they're eating, like, onion grass, then that's going to get passed on, too. There's differences between cows that are eating in the lowlands and cows that are eating high up in the Alps, again, because of what they're eating. So that will make some sort of difference. And, again, you have the pasteurization or not pasteurization question, which will also affect the flavor quite a bit. But yeah, you know, if the cow's eating it, then it's going to show up in the cheese. And remember also that when you make cheese, you're getting rid of 90% of the water, so you're concentrating everything by a factor of 10. So that's going to really show up.
Let's go to our phone lines now. We've got John joining us in Racine. Hi, John.
Hello. I was wondering if there is any advantage when you buy cheese, some of them will come with a wax wrapper instead of a plastic wrapper. Does that make any real difference?
No, not really. That's mostly that's tradition. We have Edam and Gouda, for instance, which come with the traditional wax on them. And some cheddars are made with like a black wax on it, and some of them are made with plastic wrapping or whatever. And a lot of that is just a traditional way of doing things, that the wax will really keep the moisture in pretty well, and that will help it ripen a lot. But a lot of these cheeses, when they're sitting on the shelf ripening, they don't have anything on them at all. So this is just sort of like window dressing, but there are some effects that the wax will have.
Okay, well, thanks so much for your question, John. And let's go on to Evan in Green Bay. Hi, Evan.
Hi. I recently tried a Gruyere cheese, and as I was eating it, I noticed that it tasted a little bit like Parmesan cheese, and it has a firmness more than like a cheddar. And so I was wondering if Gruyere is related to Parmesan or if they're made in similar ways.
They're actually made a bit differently. Now, with Parmesan especially, that they try to get that cheese pretty hard. So with that one, they also add a lipase, which is an enzyme which breaks down the fat and creates additional flavors doing that. But then with the Parmesan, they let that age for literally for years before it's served, so that it gets really dried out and very flavorful. Gruyere isn't quite the same way, but the thing is that you know, in cheese, you're going to get a lot of the same flavors over different varieties, just because you're starting with the same starting material, which is milk, and you're going to have some of the same microorganisms in there, so you're going to get some of the same products, and you're going to get some of the same flavors in different cheeses, even though they're made differently. But no, Gruyere and Parmesan aren't really part of the same family, but there are no similarities in flavor between those and with lots of other cheeses.
Well, thanks for that call, Evan. Hope that answers your question. And we'll read this one from Joan in Park Falls. She wonders, are there any cheeses that lactose intolerant people can eat? I heard that some aged cheese should be safe, but I don't want to take a chance without knowing for certain.
Well, when I mentioned that you have the starter culture being added, they eat the lactic acid, they eat the lactose, the milk sugar, to form lactic acid. So that gets rid of the lactose. So if you have a cheese that's aged, you're not going to have any lactose in there. So a lactose intolerant person ought to be able to eat it. The fresh cheeses are the ones that could be a problem, because there's still some lactose in there because you don't have the bacteria consuming those. So if you get with, harder cheese like cheddar or Swiss or the Parmesan that we mentioned, those should be fine for a lactose intolerant person. Now, if the person is actually allergic to, say, milk protein, then cheese is going to be out completely. But if you're lactose intolerant, then aged cheese ought to be fine.
In terms of trends in cheese, how are we doing as far as what cheese is the most popular here in the United States?
Well, for a number of years now, the trend has been toward increasing consumption of mozzarella, and that's because of the popularity of pizza. So it had been that cheddar was king, but until the 1990s, and then mozzarella passed it. So right now, about 34% of the cheese that's made in the United States is mozzarella, and cheddar is down to about 30%. So that is the big trend. There's another trend is something that I've worked on, and that's Hispanic cheese. That since you're getting a growing Hispanic population, you're getting increases in queso fresco and queso blanco and cotija and these Oaxaca and these other Mexican and Central South American cheeses that weren't quite so popular before. So that's about 2% of the production in the United States, but 10 or 15 years ago, it was almost 0%. They didn't even keep track of it. So that's one that's kind of up and coming.
Hmm. Well, Michael,
another trend is Swiss cheese. The consumption of that is going down. And, you know, it's one of my favorites, but that's, you know, decreasing at the expense of some of these other varieties.
And that was going to be my next question. If you could, if you could only eat one cheese for the rest of your life as someone who knows about all these cheeses and how they're made, what would you pick?
Well, there, you know, it depends on the mood you're in. I mean, Stilton is one that I really like. That's a blue-veined cheese where you have the mold powder that's skewered into the cheese, and it grows in there, and you get these lovely veins, and you get different flavors than you would with these other cheeses. So that and Gorgonzola, and those are cheeses that I really like. One thing about the American consumer is that they're usually brought up on bland cheeses, like American cheese, and so they don't really develop a taste for the very flavorful cheeses, which is kind of too bad. But, you know, the flavorful cheeses are the ones that I like.
Is American cheese actually a cheese?
Yeah, there are different standards depending on how it's made. Basically, they take cheddar cheese, some older cheddar, and they take some younger cheddar that doesn't have much flavor, and they grind them up, mix them together, add an emulsifier, and what you have is pasteurized processed American cheese, or if you have more of one thing or less of another, then it's pasteurized processed cheese food or cheese product or that kind of thing. It all depends on whether you're adding different things to it or how spreadable it is. So the FDA has these different regulations. But it isn't a natural cheese because you take natural cheese and you make the American cheese with it.
Well, Michael, it's interesting stuff. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thanks for having me on.
That was Michael Tunick, a research chemist with the USDA's Agricultural Research Service and the author of The Science of Cheese.
Crystal Chan grew up a multiracial kid in Wisconsin. She's been finding her place and answering people's questions about her place ever since.
Growing up in Oshkosh was ideal in many ways. There were quiet streets, woods to explore, clear, starry night skies. The only thing missing were other mixed-race kids like me. I'd get the question a lot, what are you? I'd give my routine answer. My dad is Chinese and my mom is white, so I am half and half. Sometimes people would cock their heads, confused. Sometimes they would ask how my parents could ever have possibly met. Sometimes their eyebrows would raise and they would say, gosh, you're so exotic. In the beginning, I liked their questions and their various reactions. I'd make people guess what I was, and I'd get everything from Russian to Filipino to Greek to Spanish. No one would ever guess correctly. And as I got older, when I'd tell people the truth, sometimes they would retort that I'm wrong, I'm not half Chinese. On more than one occasion, someone demanded that I show my driver's license as proof. Proof of my own existence, I guess. Later on in college, the question, what are you, started to bother me. First of all, why am I a what when everyone else is a who? And more importantly, I wasn't sure why the question mattered so very much in the first place. Once, someone stared at me from the other side of the street, crossed over, and demanded to know what I was. Like most cases, she didn't want to get to know me. When I told her what my mix was, she muttered, "I knew you didn't fit," and promptly walked away. It's said that the United States is a melting pot, but I'm not sure that we, as a country, across the generations, are comfortable with the realities of that melting. Maybe we prefer more the tossed salad approach, different items thrown in together but still separate. If the melting pot image is at all true, then this country has an insatiable hunger to know what exactly is being melted together. I get the exotic line frequently, meant always as a compliment. "Oh, I'm so plain, but you are so exotic," people would say. But when I'd look in the mirror, I wouldn't see anyone exotic. I just see plain old me. Exotic means something doesn't grow naturally in its habitat, that it's from another part of the world, that it doesn't quite belong. Wisconsin was where I was born and raised. I know the country roads. How could I possibly be out of place? How could I possibly be exotic? It took me a long time to realize that the word exotic reflects only the speaker's perspective, not at all what or who the person is speaking about. For example, an orchid is exotic in Wisconsin. Snow is exotic in Singapore. I'm waiting for the day when the word exotic won't pop up anymore when I give my racial background, because we'll be used to races mixing, no matter where we live. In the meantime, I look forward to conversations where race is not a point of alienation or objectification, but a starting point for dialogue, where we can celebrate our uniqueness as well as our points of deepest connection. When people now tell me I'm exotic, I smile and thank them for the compliment, knowing also that the humid smell of cornfields runs deep in my blood.
Crystal Chan is a writer, professional storyteller, and the author of a young adult novel. The title is Bird.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a collaboration between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org and check out the Wisconsin Life Facebook page.
For more on the topic of multiracial identity and questions like, what are you and where are you from? We have Jennifer Patrice Sims in the studio with us. She's researching these issues as a doctoral candidate in sociology at UW-Madison. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, is this question just really a daily part of life for people with multiple racial backgrounds?
For some people, yes, it is. I would, when asking interviewees about the question, I would get responses from, I was asked earlier today, I was asked last week, I was asked last month. So people, yes, they receive this question very, very often.
And is it universally an annoying question?
It is not universally annoying. For about half of my respondents, they found the question very annoying, very tiresome. Like Crystal Chan said, at first, when you're younger, you answer. But as you get into your 20s, into your 30s, into your 40s, this does become very wearisome. So for about half of my interviewees, they found the question annoying and cumbersome.
Well, I don't know if everyone knows the motivations behind asking it. As Crystal said there, at least one woman explicitly said, I knew you didn't fit. But is it sometimes maybe not malicious, maybe just curiosity expressed awkwardly?
Yes. So there's usually two reasons that the interviewees that I interviewed felt that they were being asked. One was based on their appearance. Their appearance, as Crystal said in her piece, was a bit, quote, exotic for the location that they were in. Men said that usually their light skin coupled with, say, African features or Asian features would make someone kind of wonder if they were mixed race and so ask. Women often said that the texture of their hair coupled with either their skin color or their eye shape, for example, would make people want to ask. So some would see those as, okay, someone's just being curious. You're just paying attention. If it was, people would ask parents about children. Some parents would say, well, you're just appreciating that the way my child looks like this. And so then they wouldn't see it as very annoying. Other times, though, with regards to behavior, someone would get asked. So if you have, say, a black-white person that appears maybe a little bit more black, but they're, quote, well-spoken or they're, quote, educated, then somebody may, drawing on negative stereotypes of blacks, want to know, oh, well, are you part white? As kind of maybe that's an explanation for why you don't, as one of my interviewees said, someone told him, you don't act anything like the blacks on Cops. Well, they're drawing on stereotypes and trying to ask, well, what are you? Because the person doesn't fit into their kind of explanation, their small, narrow view of what different types of racial minorities ought to be.
And I don't know if you encountered this in interviewing people, but it did it vary by place? I could see someone maybe who stood out in a maybe mostly white community getting the question a lot. Somebody maybe in an urban environment with lots of international people in and out, it might not be noticed at all.
Exactly, yes. So my dissertation is comparative. I'm looking at the United States and the United Kingdom. Mm. And many interviewees mentioned that getting asked the question a lot less in London. It's such a metropolitan city. It's so cosmopolitan that they just sort of blend in. Everyone's from somewhere else. Everyone is, there's a large mixed race population versus when they were growing up, say, in the south of England or, say, growing up in Yorkshire in the north of England or here in America, folks growing up in rural Wisconsin, then they move to, say, New York or they move to Los Angeles. And it's a bigger city, then they do notice that the questions come less when they are in bigger multicultural cosmopolitan places.
I've seen some controversy online over the other question, where are you from? Is that one you looked into?
I did. That question is more often asked in the United Kingdom, given the difference in our histories of immigration. Mm. the United States has had non-white citizens here ever since the founding versus the United Kingdom. It's been a much smaller population. It's only been since World War II and the fall of the different colonies that non-whites have immigrated and mixed in the United Kingdom. So there, where are you from is the what are you basically question that we get more here in the United States.
I've seen it here more in the context of Asian Americans, people, where are you from? Northern California. No, where are you from? Well, L.A. before that. And eventually, if you trace back five generations, you get to another country in that conversation.
Yes, that is a particular, there's a research in sociology on how Asians are seen as forever foreigners. Where are you from? California. Where are your parents from? California. Where are your grandparents from? As one of my interviews said, why does it matter where my ancestors are from 500 years ago?
Well, take this all together, the who are you, where are you from, and this notion of being exotic. When you're talking to people here in the U.S., in the U.K., is there a sense of like, I don't know, I'm not accepted here?
There is, exactly as Crystal said, if you're seen as exotic, that means you're not accepted in this place. And that's why this question, where are you from, what are you, why, can become so wearisome over the course of days, months, years when you're asked, because you're constantly not seen as from the place that you feel like you are from.
Is there a more positive way to have this conversation, either something you've observed or a way that you've heard from the people you've talked to?
Yes, actually, if you're in the context of getting to know someone, if you're meeting a new friend, you're making a new friend, you're establishing connection, then most of my interviewees did not mind being asked where they're from. They didn't mind being asked, what race are you? It was in the context, as Crystal said in her piece, someone coming up to her across the street, people coming up to you in grocery stores when you're shopping, just in different places. They're not trying to get to know you. They've just seen you, racially objectified you, and now they want to ask you this, you know, somewhat personal question to some people. But in the context of we're meeting new friends, we're making connections, we're establishing relationships, then it can be seen as a very positive. It's discussing the way we are mixed. It's discussing our backgrounds. And so then it's fine.
So more getting to know than, I guess, fitting into a category.
Exactly. If you're trying to just pigeonhole someone and you're just looking at them and because of your range of understanding of phenotypes, you can't place them. If that's your only rationale for asking someone, well, then the person's probably going to see that as a bit disrespectful. But if you're making a new friend, if you're establishing a new connection and you're just generally trying to get to know someone, then, you know, you can ask back and forth. You can ask where they're from. They can ask where you're from and you can establish that bond and that rapport.
We'll leave it there. Jen, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jennifer Patrice Sims. She's a doctoral student in sociology at UW-Madison.